Football Weekly Extra from The Guardian in association with sportingbet.com.
Football Weekly Extra. Today, Manchester Derby Part 2. Carlos stages late City rally, but Wayne whacks in winner. While United fans prove City aren't the only ones who can throw their money around. Elsewhere, as Juventus caught Rafa Benitez, the pod asks, does Rafa have a duty to try and rescue Liverpool's season, though? Or might he end up staying? Elsewhere, we listen to Paul Doyle on the can, the Africa Cup of Nations, of course, as the tournament nears its climax. And we look forward to all the weekend action, including the big game at the Emirates with Sol Campbell up against Wayne Rooney. Will Wayne, not for the first time, have his wicked way with the old-timer at the back? All that in today's Football Weekly Extra. Hello, everybody. Bit of a collector's item lineup today, then, with Barry Glendening.
Hello.
Hi, Barry. Paul Doyle.
Hi, James.
Hi to you, Paul. And, for possibly the last time ever, head of sport, Ben Clissett. Ben.
Hi, James.
It's a sad day, isn't it?
Well, for me, I mean, this is my World Cup final. So
really?
For me, it's just, I don't think things are going to get any better for me, so.
Right, and you're Zidane in the sense that this is, you know, your swan song. You're leaving on a high.
Well, a lot of people have muttered comments to me as they walk past me over the last couple of weeks, because I'm leaving next week. And once I was booked for this, I thought there's no point in going on. Journalism holds nothing for me anymore.
Yeah, all right, okay. Good. May well prove true. It certainly worked out that way for me. good. Just a quick letter here from the Premier League. Barry, you were asking why Ricardo Fuller's allowed to wear his fancy down earrings when nobody else is. But Tim Vine, head of public affairs at the Premier League, says, no, that's not true. He doesn't wear earrings. These are removed prior to kickoff. And what you might be noticing is the little bits of tape they put over the holes.
But I've seen close-ups and the little bits of tape actually go through the holes. So it's quite bizarre.
Well, it might be very, I don't know.
Anyway, yeah, I've apparently have done Ricardo Fuller a grave injustice,
well,
and
indeed.
For that I apologise.
Mark Jefford tweets in, Ben, to say, what do you think about the potential of the iPad for The Guardian's sport content?
Well, clearly, as I'm leaving next week, I haven't thought about it kind of very deeply.
Oh,
but
I bet you have.
It's a very exciting moment.
Right, okay. It's like an iPod, but bigger, so you could read. A lot of publishers are looking forward to, you know.
They are. I saw the pictures of them this morning. It seemed to be sort of as big as a dustbin lid, which I wasn't sure if they're supposed to be useful, and you can read them on kind of tubes. I wasn't sure how useful it looked, but I think that was just the angle of the pictures, I'm told. It's very handy.
Yes.
Somebody on Twitter has likened it to an Etch-a-Sketch, which is sort of
right
about that size. I don't see the point of it, to be honest. It just looks like an iPhone, but slightly more cumbersome, and I can't understand why everyone's making such a big deal out of it. I've already told you this morning that I am against the iPhone,
and
because it turns people who own them into morons.
Right. Okay. Next on Tech Weekly, we're going to talk about the Carling Cup semi-final second leg. A thrilling match, especially the second half. Some super goals. That Tevez one was a bit special, wasn't it? From the rich man's poor Dirk Kuyt. What was it, Paul? Tell me again.
The rich man's Dirk Kuyt.
Was it? Yes.
Yeah.
And it was a special goal, wasn't it? Do you know he's now scored, how many goals has he scored this season? 18 or something in all competitions?
I do know that. Yeah, he's in a good run of form.
Yep.
Not quite good enough to help his team into the final, alas.
No.
But he's playing well at the moment. City didn't quite play well enough. They contained United in the first half. But then I think, unlike Tevez's jibes, towards Gary Neville towards the match, Ferguson's comments before the match turned out to be justified, because he talked about how a greater experience in big games would pay off, and that's how it proved. I was doubtful about the wisdom of selecting Ryan Giggs and Paul Scholes in what I thought was going to be a very highly charged and intense game, but they turned out to have crucial roles in keeping possession and keeping City pinned back, and City retreated ever deeper as the stakes mounted towards the end, and ultimately it was United who kept their head and kept the pressure on and got the winning goal.
Indeed they did. Now, I know you're not one to write United off, but there have been one or two people around here who have been saying that, you know, they're a fading force, etc. Do you think, though, that as Craigie Anderson tweets, that this win over City could be the catalyst that gives them the edge to win the title? Are you reconsidering your view of them as a not top four team after this performance?
Not really, no. I have to bear in mind that that their experience partially paid off, because City were without their most experienced defenders. Jolyon Lescott and Kolo Touré may have made a difference, although Boyata and company did play well. but didn't have the sang-froid to not that Lescott and have had that in recent games either. But City aren't the pinnacle of football just yet. I don't think this United team would beat Chelsea, for example, at the moment. We'll see how they do against Arsenal on Sunday as well.
Well, he certainly will. In the meantime, Adam Hall tweeting saying, "Do you think Man U will be fairly punished for hurling bottles, amongst other things, coins as well, at Craig Bellamy? If it was a smaller club," he says, ...
Well, the implication there is that a smaller club would be hammered, and I presume that's what the implication is, and that Manchester United will get away fairly easily. But the fact of the matter is, every club has a few goons who, among their support, who will throw coins, throw bottles, whatever. It's probably better off focusing on the vast majority, who don't do it. But if those people are caught and punished and the club get a fine, then I think that's all you can do. There's no point in
You can't ignore these. I mean, Craig Bellamy going to take a corner and getting hit on the back of the head with a coin.
Yeah, I know, it happened. But in the first leg, somebody threw a cigarette lighter at Patrice Evra.
Mm.
So, it just happens at games. It's unfortunate that it happens. But, you can't sling teams out of tournaments for it, I think, because then you're going to have spies going in amongst the home support, throwing missiles,
It happened in Italy.
It also shows you can't... United said that everyone will be frisked on the way in, and it just shows you can't frisk 70,000 people. Right.
Well, no, I mean, you can't take their money off them,
It might be an idea, especially in Old Trafford. It's interesting you should mention that. Obligatory Italian reference, because Fiorentina, who were once having a home stadium ban in Europe, were forced to play one of their UEFA Cup matches down in Salerno. And one of the local fans... I had the clever idea of getting Fiorentina into hot water by throwing a bomb at the linesman. It went off, severely injuring the linesman, knocking him out. And as a result, Fiorentina were banned from Europe. So there you go.
Just interested in Barry's schedule of permissibility, where coins and cigarette lighters are okay. I'm just wondering, where would the bomb go? Is that it happens. You come to football, someone throws a bomb. That's the kind of stuff that happens.
Well, I'm not suggesting it's okay to throw them. I'm just suggesting it's okay to have them in your pocket.
Right.
Cigarette lighters and coins.
You shouldn't punish the clubs from them, just the individuals.
I think you should fine the clubs, and it should be a hefty fine. Hmm. But I don't think... Some people are saying that they should be slung out of the tournament. I don't think that's fair.
Right.
And in terms of Man United, you said you couldn't. It's not right for them to take money off people on the way in. I mean, surely isn't the lesson of the last few weeks that kind of, at home or on the way in, that's kind of what's happening.
I think what was worse by far was the reaction to Emmanuel Adebayor being brought on, with a lot of people in the crowd making machine gun gestures his way. They were also singing songs about his parents, which... pretty vile, and I think that's an issue that needs to be more urgently addressed than one or two morons throwing a coin or a bottle.
How should that be addressed?
I think clubs should be fined if the songs go beyond the pale like that. Manchester United supporters get very, very upset if anyone makes airplane gestures at their team, so surely it's a bit hypocritical of them to be making machine gun gestures at Emmanuel Adebayor.
Very much so. I did enjoy Van der Sar racing over when the coins were thrown at Bellamy to immediately face the crowd. He did seem to be giving them a bit of a stern look. A lot of times you'll see opposition players perhaps sheepishly asking if fans wouldn't mind calming down a bit. But Van der Sar did seem to be pretty much on board on the stop this nonsense.
Bellamy helped United's cause as well, actually. He could have exaggerated that or reacted with more pain and drawn it out a bit longer, but he more or less got straight back up and didn't make a big deal out of it.
Or climb into the crowd and take them on.
He left his golf clubs at home, unfortunately, and he couldn't get the right. He was looking for the pitching wedge, and
someone could have thrown
the moment went.
Just going back to the game,
yes.
I think the match was further evidence that Manchester City desperately need a good goalkeeper, because their best keeper at the moment is playing for Birmingham City. Shea Given is not good enough to be in goal for a team with title aspirations.
Really? He looked pretty good to me.
He made one stunning save from a shot, which is all he's good for, really. He can't command his area. He was anchored to the line when Rooney scored the winner. Any defence I've ever seen, said it before in the pod, any defence that plays in front of him is jittery, and it can't be coincidence that every defence he's ever played behind has been poor. And plus, no massive team in the world has ever tried to buy him. There must be a reason for that.
The Irish defence, Republic of Ireland defence, has been pretty good behind him or in front of him.
You've also got to look at the players Man City have got in front of him, and clearly they didn't have their first choice centre backs out last night. But you know, the first choice centre backs aren't necessarily, you know, what you would call top class. I mean, when Kolo Touré was at Arsenal, you know, and he had lots of very good games, but he frequently made mistakes as well, standing in the wrong place positionally. Naive, I think, is the word that people use. So I don't think you can... I mean, I think given one of the better things about the Man City defence.
Joe Hart has played well for Birmingham this year, but I haven't seen much evidence that he's a great man for dominating the box either.
Interesting, interesting. No doubt the posters will have their say on this controversial topic. Next up for United, of course, they face Aston Villa now in the Carling Cup final in a month. But before that, this weekend, they visit their title rivals, Arsenal. They've moved past them now into second place, United. And they could put a further dent in the Gunners' title aspirations with, of course, a victory at the Emirates. A game that will be shown in selected pubs in London in 3D.
Very exciting. So when the pizzas start being thrown in the tunnel, you'll be able to see kind of all of the pepperoni and just the cheese still bubbling on the top. And I think it's a fantastic innovation from Sky, and we should applaud them for it.
Well, I'm certainly looking forward to it myself. It is going to be a very big game for Arsenal, who, of course, come into it in the worst shape possible. They've just been held 0-0 by Aston Villa in the other big Wednesday game. Hit the post a couple of times, but lost a couple more players to injury. I think Eduardo's out. Briefly at least, but most seriously, Thomas Vermaelen has a suspected or now confirmed broken leg and thus is out for the rest of the season. Is that right?
Well, he has a suspected broken leg at the time of broadcast. Yes. It may well have been confirmed by the time our listeners get their hands on get this in their ears. He's a huge loss for them because he's been one of their best players this season, and chances are if he has broken leg or is going to be out for some time, Sol Campbell will be coming in to replace him. So we have the prospect then of seeing Sol Campbell up against Wayne Rooney at the weekend.
Almost as appetising as that pepperoni in 3D.
I mean, the 3D I'm not sold on. I've never been a huge fan of 3D. I don't really see the point of it. But I'm off to Avatar this evening to see if that's, you know, going to change my mind, but I doubt it will. But Sol Campbell got left in Richard Dunn's dust last night, and I worry for him about what Wayne Rooney might do to him.
Do you think we'll see him in the second half or not?
Pardon?
Do you think he'll come out for the second half or not? How bad was Campbell against Villa? Because some people are saying, you mentioned the fact that Richard Dunn seemed to have the edge over him in terms of pace, which is a worrying thought.
Very worrying.
But others have said, and after all, the game finished goalless, so Villa didn't score anything.
Yeah, I think at the weekend, though, in the cup match, and it's difficult to judge because it is his first game back. I mean, clearly, apart from the sort of Notts County game, and it does take people a while to get a match fit, but he didn't look hugely comfortable. Stoke's not a great start, I guess. It's very physical and a difficult sort of re-entry, but he looked very uncomfortable. And I think that, you know, pace is such a huge issue, really, for defenders. That if the evidence of Richard Dunn and Sol Campbell last night is the truth, then you can just see how teams will play against Arsenal and what they'll throw at him.
I think Arsenal are vulnerable in other areas as well. I think one of the reasons Alex Ferguson rested Valencia last night is because he intends to have a go at Arsenal's left back. I mean, teams targeted Armand Traoré over the last few weeks and he was found wanting in a big way. But since Clichy has come back from, admittedly, a long injury, he hasn't yet regained his form of, not so much immediately prior to his injury because he wasn't in good form then either, but of, say, last season. So that would be an area they'll certainly target. I think it's important also that Alex Song is available and fit because Danielson hasn't been doing it as good a job as Song had been doing until his departure to the African Nations Cup. I'm not sure how drained he is from that African Nations Cup, but that would be interesting to watch. Eduardo's injury may not be so serious because I think he hasn't performed well in that lone striker role. It's not his game playing with his back to goal. Whereas Nicholas Bentner is more likely, if he is fully fit, is more likely to prosper in that role.
Right. And Wayne Rooney, with now 19 league goals, as we mentioned on Monday, and having his best season ever at United.
And very interesting how he's taken responsibility since Ronaldo has gone to Spain. And, you know, the interesting thing there as well is how that might impact on England and how Capello might look at the world slightly differently if he's playing Rooney as the most advanced man and then a player off Rooney. And that might be sort of, you always wonder, you know, whether the Heskey and Rooney thing was really going to win a World Cup. And it just might be that there's an opportunity through Man United's kind of experimentation and need to do things differently, that might have a benefit for England and for people like Defoe, whoever might be able to play off him.
No. We're going to be actually having a quick chat about one of England's upcoming World Cup opponents, Algeria, in a moment or two, when we get the skinny on the situation there in Angola. We'll also be having a look through your posts and all sorts of other worldwide sports news right after this.
Football Weekly from The Guardian, in association with SportingBet.com.
Africa, Paul Doyle, semi-finals are today.
That's
yeah.
right.
Yeah. Ghana, Nigeria.
Yeah, they'll probably be over by the time this goes out.
Exactly.
So Egypt. If I can record my predictions later, that would be perfect.
No. Well, as I say, Ghana and taking on Nigeria in one. And then Egypt, the form team, it's fair to say, to the tournament so far against their rivals Algeria, the team that just last November stopped them, of course, from going to the World Cup. Two cracking semi-final matchups of which we can't really talk too much. But then the overall feeling, though, that these two games and the final need to lift an otherwise underwhelming tournament.
Yeah, I think, as I said last time, it's been underwhelming in terms of quality. The teams have been showing their shortcomings rather than their qualities in general. But there has been no lack of drama and excitement, so it has been an engaging tournament from that point of view, which is increasingly, I think, the way international football is going. The last African Nations Cup was like that. Even Euro 2008 could be said to be like that if you compare it to, say, the Champions League. Mm. International football is a little bit more helter-skelter and tense, which I welcome for one. And as for Algeria, I didn't expect them to get this far after the beginning they made to the tournament. They've since explained that their lackluster beginning, when they were pounded 3-0 by Malawi, was partially because they were still psychologically drained from their World Cup playoff against Egypt and all the incidents that surrounded that. But since then, they've recovered, and of course they beat Ivory Coast in a sensational match in the quarterfinal when, well, we'll come to in a moment how bad Ivory Coast were in that match. But Algeria showed that they will be serious opponents to England. They're, in terms of warrior spirit and whatnot, they're certainly not lacking. But also they reverted to the formation that had got them to the World Cup, a three-man central defence. They'd begun the tournament in slightly more conservative fashion, which I think was perhaps an attempt to prepare for the World Cup because they didn't want to be too gung-ho there against perhaps superior teams. But they've since reverted to their customary formation and they were a real threat. Sorry, you're pointing at me.
I am pointing at you, because a couple of posters, our Hatton Bomb says they could have had four more. Again, what was the score? Was it 3-1?
Against the Ivory Coast. Yeah, it was 3-2 in extra
3-2,
time.
And they could have had four more. So
the Ivory Coast capitulated in a way I've seldom seen any team do in extra
Gonzoid
time.
Gonzoid saying that all this was without the real Algeria, that they didn't have their best players out in that game. Is that true?
They were missing a couple of players, right. but it wasn't a second string entirely.
Okay.
But Ivory Coast had pretty much their first team, and their coach, and there's talk now that they're going to change their coach ahead of the World Cup, because Vahid Halilhodžić has been criticised mostly for declining to replace Didier Drogba, who has gone from hero status in the Ivory Coast to almost a pariah, because he did virtually nothing throughout this tournament, and the manager, it's believed, was afraid to take him off and replace him because of his status within right. the team. And at the last Nations Cup, he was criticised, where, of course, again, Ivory Coast failed to fulfil their potential. And he was criticised. He was said to have too much of an influence on the team and trying to get involved almost in managing the team in terms of who plays and who doesn't. And he had given a press conference before this match saying that there was going to be much more humility from his part ahead of this match. And I saw one Ivorian journalist saying that he was so humble that he didn't even bother bothering the opponents throughout the tournament.
Andy Graham, 66, posting tweeting in saying, why are Ivory Coast 29-1 to win the World Cup? And it's a fair question. Barry, You were suggesting that the only African team who looked like they could make an impact in South Africa or Egypt, who aren't going anywhere.
Yeah.
But Algeria, what kind of odds should they be at, do you think, Paul?
They'd still be... To win the World Cup, I think they'd be fairly long still.
But they could well cause major problems in their group.
Well, England shouldn't take them lightly, that's for sure. I think Ghana, we mentioned before the tournament that they're very much an understrength team, and they were hoping that some youngsters who they've called on for this tournament would come to the fore and then compete with more established stars for a place in the summer lineup. And they've been good. Obviously, they've got to the semi-final. They've played well, and they've still got a host of stars. I mean, to come back into the team ahead of the World Cup. Even Michael Essien, who is in Angola but hasn't played hardly, will be there. So they're a strong team. And Cameroon, you just don't know with them, because I think that they will certainly... Paul again will certainly revamp his squad ahead of the World Cup, and they have a lot of potential too. So it's not all doom and gloom for the African teams.
So you're saying that Essien's barely played and Drogba played but didn't actually do very much. So lump on Chelsea for the title. Is that the message from Angola?
It seems to be the way, yeah. They certainly won't be tired when they come back.
Yeah, indeed so. Well, there you go. The final coming up on Sunday. Meanwhile, elsewhere in the wide world of football, that shock story in Mexico, Salvador Cabanas, Paraguayan football hero, top scorer in their qualifying, shot in the head in the bathroom of a bar.
You sound really pleased.
I'm not pleased at all. It's just a bizarre story. It turns out, or at least the latest theory, is that he had a row with a man over a Cuban dancer that they both like. It's extraordinary stuff. And the doctors still haven't managed to take the bullet out of his head. Appalling story for him and his family. And of course, Paraguay, Paraguayan football. Big thing ahead of the World Cup.
It's also disappointing news for Sunderland, because they were trying to sign him.
Were they?
And I would imagine their interest may have waned considerably in light of recent events.
Well, yeah. Well, a big get well soon, anyway, to Senor Cabanas. Other news, Crystal Palace in administration. This left our pre-pod meeting underwhelmed.
It left you underwhelmed.
No, I thought it was
I'm quite whelmed by it.
I'm whelmed by it, Barry. And I feel terrible for Neil Warnock. I'm from the Warnock camp. I know that life is divided into two kinds of people. I'm a pro-Neil fellow, and he'd done a tremendous job, I thought, Ben.
He had done a tremendous job, and they were doing well. It was quite interesting. We were looking yesterday at the sort of one of the latest finance agreements that Crystal Palace had entered into, in which they'd sold future income or borrowed money against future income. It's a fantastic schedule of what had actually been borrowed against, which I'm going to try to apply to my own life now I'm going to be unemployed. They'd borrowed against the club crest and any use of it. They'd borrowed against future Football League television income, and interestingly, future Football League, future Premier League television income, and also the parachute payment. So they covered all. They covered anything that happened to Palace had been covered in this document. So there's a remarkable piece of work. These financial pressures are obviously very present, aren't they, in football at the moment? Just on the way up, someone downstairs as a Portsmouth fan was saying their website is not working anymore. We're not quite sure why, but I don't know if that's to do with financial pressures or not. But that's these things are...
Well, the exciting news for fans down on the south coast is that apparently Sadio Gaddafi might be coming in to rescue their situation. He's had a happy relationship with the sport of football. You'll no doubt recall that he took a place on the board at Juventus and then took on a playing role at Perugia.
That was right.
I say playing role... but he actually managed to get a 3-month doping suspension without ever taking the field, because he was sitting on the bench one day when he was randomly dope tested and came up positive. So
marvelous effort. I mean, not many people. Yeah. Not many people manage that in their football career.
No, indeed not. So there you go. I'm sure his money would be welcome at Fratton Park. Moving on, posts, plenty of posts. Mike in Brazil wants to defend Robinho, who he feels got a bit of an unfair treatment, and says he's been vital pretty much everywhere he's played, and perhaps less so at City, which has been a move that was wrong for him right from the start. But in spite of this, he was one of the leading scorers in the Premier last year, and he says he was the man when Real Madrid won the title under Capello, and this went unrecognised in the midst of all the circus about some bloke called Beckham. Dirk wants to know if Brazilians are now too mentally weak for Premier League clubs to be interested in them. You look at the problems that Adriano, Ronaldo, Joe, Robinho, Ronaldinho have had in Europe, and Diego and Kaká are struggling, says Dirk.
Ronaldinho didn't do too badly in Europe. All the
Kaká's done all right.
Kaká's done okay. Diego did pretty well at Werder Bremen before his current problems at Juventus, which are possibly more to do with the club than he himself. Mr. Garethy has been listening to Fighting Talk, and apparently Corin Murray made some reference to Berlusconi doing a lap of honour at the 2007 Champions League final, introduced by me in several languages. That's never took place. Never took place.
You sure?
Oh, producer Pete was listening to this, and he said in seven different languages. Well, I thank Colin for that, but no. I did introduce the event, and it is true that Silvio Berlusconi did do a lap of honour, carried, I believe, at a certain point by the players, but I wasn't in any way his personal MC for the event. That is an honour which awaits me perhaps one day, but as yet hasn't.
If the money was right, you would be prepared to be his personal MC.
That's not a question, is it, Barry?
No. It's a statement.
Yeah. Okay, Sulfur, thanks for updating us on the Robert Snodgrass affair. It was his performances in an under 19 European Championship tournament that alerted Barcelona to his talents. Livingston apparently didn't let him go and do the trial. Algarve Guna and Monte Rotondo want Portuguese updates, especially with Sporting Braga looking like they might take one of the Champions League spots, leaving Sporting Lisbon and Porto in the other cup. Barry?
No, I just wanted to mention we were talking about clubs in crisis there, and because I forgot to mention it in the Manchester United Man City thing, all the number of Manchester United fans wearing the green and gold of Newton Heath as a protest against the Glazers. And it's pretty pathetic, I think, because...
Why?
Well, the Glazers aren't going to care less, and I think if Manchester United fans really want to get rid of them, they have to just stop going to games.
And where do they get the...
These token gestures of buying, you know, green and gold scarves outside the ground, which are possibly being sold to them by agents of the Glazers, you know, working undercover.
Right.
So it's a gesture, but it's a feeble gesture.
Right.
They have to stop going to games. If they really loved their club, they would stop going to watch them.
Hmm. I don't want to disagree with Barry. In fact, no, I disagree with him all the time. Of course, I want to disagree with Barry. It's always a good position to assume the opposite of what Barry says. But I think they've got a perfect right to do it, and I think it's absolutely a positive thing to express what you feel about your club. I think it's reasonable for them to want to go to games and to see them. I think it's reasonable for them want to continue to pay money. And I think it's reasonable for them to have a voice. I don't think you have to kind of necessarily deprive yourself of you're seeing your team just to make a point about the ownership. It seems to me.
But if they want the Glazers out, so they have to decide which do I want more? Do I want to watch my team win, you know, the next three games, or am I prepared to stay away from those three games? At which point, the owners will realise we're serious about wanting them out and sell up because the money isn't coming in anymore.
But I think clearly that if you own the club, and if there are, you know, if there are financial strictures around the club, and you see this thing visibly happening in your stadium, it does give you a different sense about your investment, a different sense about the business. I think it is effective, and it may be that people will go on to not go to games. But I don't think it's, you know, if that's the way those fans feel, I don't think it's a meaningless gesture.
Mm. Isn't one of the really depressing things about the Glazers' tenure at Man United the fact that this was a club that actually did have a very well-organised opposition to their takeover, and now there's actually really very little that the fans could do. I mean, such are the numbers and such are the kind of finances involved that they could stop going to games, they could do pretty much what they want, wear whatever they want, and nothing's going to really change unless the Glazers receive some massive offer or go bankrupt, or that's the only kind of thing that can really bring about a change. I can't imagine that a few fans not attending, which apparently is already happening, is going to make that.
No,
much
I don't mean a few. I mean a half-empty ground, an empty ground.
Well, I suppose that would certainly send a message.
It would solve the problem with people throwing bottles.
or make them easier to detect anyway.
In a bomb, the guy with the bomb would have no chance.
Okay, well, now I'll just conclude this part with a couple of other posts. Julius B wants more coverage of the Ryman Unibond League Premier Division, especially Durham City, who are on course for a truly record-breaking season. Durham City, 21 games played, no wins, no draws, 21 defeats, 108 goals conceded, 13 scored, a goal difference of minus 95.
That does constitute more coverage, I think, so yeah. That's done.
All right, that's that one done.
That reminds me, actually, yep. The league table you showed me one day, of the league your son plays in,
yes.
And the team that was at the bottom, like they played 15, lost 15, scored none, and conceded about 358.
Indeed they have.
Have they won a game yet?
No. But I have to say, having seen them in action, the parents, fantastic. They come along and support and cheer. You know, they're tremendously Corinthian spirit. But
they wear green and gold at any point? Yeah,
No. Dear. Now, that's it for part two. Plenty still to come, though, with Rafa Benitez, Juventus, and all the weekend action to be discussed. Now, one of the most surprising stories to emerge on Monday, straight after our pod, conveniently enough, was Juventus' attempts to sign up top manager Rafael Benitez of high-flying Liverpool. As things stand, he is still apparently their number one choice for next season. And because he's not going to come straight away, they're going to get somebody else in as a tragatore, a ferryman, if you like. And Claudio Gentile is said to have already agreed terms with them. Claudio Gentile, of course, a bit of a legend at the back. No-nonsense man for Juve back in the 70s, 80s. And, of course, at the World Cup, where he gave Maradona his very, very special care and attention with World Cup winning results. Actually, well done to Gentile for that, and I think he'll do a terrific job if he takes over, because he is a hard, stern, straight-talking... What is he, Barry? What's the phrase I'm looking for?
He's hard.
He's hard, that's it, exactly. In a word. And
he doesn't brook any bullshit.
Exactly so. And he won a European Championship as manager of Italy's under-21 side. He was very successful. A man with the under-21s for 6 years before he
was... So I have a question now, which my colleagues here may be able to help me. I have not yet seen a shred of evidence that Juventus want Rafa Benitez as their manager. Can anyone provide any proof that this just isn't... Well, I haven't seen a quote from anyone from Juventus. I haven't... Nothing. And who's to say this isn't just a story being cooked up by Benitez and his agent?
Nobody, and that would explain a lot.
But is there any evidence? That's what I'm asking.
But there wouldn't be. Juve are still managed by Ciro Ferrara. They have a Coppa Italia game coming up today against Inter. And it's quite possible that they might opt in the end to stick with Ferrara, even if they were going to bring in somebody else at the end of the season, just because the idea of bringing in a caretaker manager, especially if he was to win against Inter, which he already has done a month or two ago, isn't one that they find attractive. They don't think it's going to change anything, that perhaps... the situation, that the other ingredients which need changing aren't going to be changed before the end of the season, so there's no point in changing the manager, they may feel. Now, Benitez next season it's a big surprise. I'm not sure of the rationale behind it. He apparently is a big fan of Italian football, speaks fluent Italian, etc., etc. Famously beat Milan in the Champions League final, so perhaps that's why he still enjoys a certain amount of esteem in Italy. But there's nothing about what he's doing at Liverpool this season that would lead you, as another leading European club, to think this is the man to sort our problems out. I don't know. It does seem a really bizarre story, Rafa Benitez going to Juventus, but you can see how it would be appealing from his point of view.
You would. The thing is, what is it? The point is, what is it that he's going to bring? You know, what do you do as a manager? You coach players and improve them. You select players and you purchase them. You coach players for particular games. And I'm not sure that Benitez's stock is incredibly high in any of those things. So you think, okay, well, is it just because he's in the wrong place? But, you know, it wasn't incredibly high during the time that Liverpool was a much much richer club, or had much more transfer budget. And you sort of think, what would Juventus want out of that?
Mm. You know, well, it doesn't make much sense. I have to say, though, if there was any group of people who would be considering an entirely illogical course of action to try and rescue their club, it would be the current management at Juventus, especially given one or two of their previous signings who had failed to impress in previous roles but were still signed up anyway. Well, we'll find out. Maybe there'll be more on this story by next Monday. In the meantime, Liverpool whipping up enthusiasm for their manager with their latest result, a 0-0 at Wolves. Which a flurry of posts here. Stephen Gerrard saying that he felt that Liverpool had turned the corner.
That was an astonishing thing to say.
What, that they turned the corner?
It was possibly their most abject performance of the season, and there have been quite a few for anyone to choose from. And for him, is he still the club captain? To come out and say that is just
mind-boggling. He then said he felt that they could still perhaps creep into the top four, which was a lovely choice.
They probably still can.
But it's a bizarre choice of terminology.
But to use that to say, oh, we've turned a corner, right. We've drawn nil all with Wolves, that's what they've sunk to.
I mean, clearly for Gerrard, he has to inspire the team and be positive. I think one of the really interesting stories of the end of this season and possibly through England's World Cup will be, will Steven Gerrard stay? You know, he's at the age where he's got one more big contract. You would imagine he's got kind of the last bit where he can really be a huge part of a team. Does he feel that he can do that in Liverpool? If he doesn't want to do that, will he have to go abroad? And I think that's something that will probably build up. And if you remember the last World Cup, there were all those stories of his contact or not with Chelsea through the middle of it. And you just wonder whether there's going to be a similar, not necessarily with Chelsea, whether there are going to be similar questions about what he does next.
Mm. Hatton Bomb posting saying, I see Liverpool have said they've turned the corner again. That makes it four times now. Does that mean they've got back to where they started off from? Someone shoot me, please, adds Hatton Bomb. I think actually, to be fair to Gerrard, he didn't say creep into the top four. He said we might just edge into the top four. But that, of course, part of the reason for that is that they have had this run of unbeaten games. They're hosting Bolton at the weekend. That should, do you think, fuel their charge for the Champions League positions?
Yeah, you'd expect them to beat Bolton, you'd imagine so.
Mm. Elsewhere, in the battle for fourth place, all sorts of excitements. Man City, who are they up against? Man City, they're playing...
Portsmouth,
of course.
Rich against
Poor. Right, that's on Monday night. So that may well see them leap up in the standings again. They've got a couple of games in hand, have they not? Man City over the other teams they're battling with, who are Liverpool. And, of course, then Spurs, who will be at Birmingham. Now, Birmingham just had that incredible unbeaten run ended by a phenomenal performance from Chelsea. Do you see them giving Spurs a hard time?
I think it's perfectly possible, yeah. I mean, a lot of clubs have given Spurs a hard time this year, most notably Wolves at home, Stoke at home, the Liverpool match away, actually, where Liverpool at home played very much like Wolves did away in a curious kind of turnaround of events, lots of people behind the ball, not worrying a huge amount about possession. I think Spurs are quite beatable, and I think Spurs, particularly without Lennon, who is kind of a huge player and has been out for a number of weeks and maybe out for a number more if unconfirmed reports are true, they do find it difficult to break down sides. And that, you know, for instance, when Man City came to Spurs, it seemed quite clear to me that Spurs would have a better chance than they had against Wolves, because Man City came to play and Spurs played through the gaps and did very well in that game. That was sort of the end of Mark Hughes. But there is a sort of failure sometimes of imagination after, you know, if a couple of chances don't go in and then nothing really sort of seems to happen. And without Lennon, that's particularly marked. I mean, the game against Fulham on Tuesday went very well for Spurs, but it wasn't Fulham's best performance by any means. Having said that, I think Spurs are capable of finishing fourth, I think.
They'd have to win a game like this, do you think, to be a...
Yeah, and the problem is that there are too many of those games that Spurs haven't won, and they also haven't beaten the kind of the big clubs,
right?
Apart from Liverpool at the beginning of the season. But you know, this both in terms of the title, apart from Chelsea, and in terms of this fourth place spot, we're talking about a number of obviously flawed squads.
Yeah,
you know, it's only really Chelsea who you think are probably a squad of the standard that they've become used to and we've become used to watching.
Right. Chelsea, who are now 1 point clear at the top of the table with a game in hand, are at Burnley, where, of course, Burnley's a very strong, all but one of their points has come at Turf Moor. So that will be a tough test for Chelsea. In other matches, Hull taking on Wolverhampton, West Ham against Blackburn, Wigan against Everton, high-flying Everton, Landon Donovan getting his first Premier League goal in that 2-0 win over Sunderland, and Fulham, who haven't won now since the 28th of December, are facing Aston Villa. Is there a potential upset in this weekend's fixtures that you'd care to throw our way?
No.
Right. Paul, any surprises?
No, sorry, I'm sure there are, but I'm just not prepared to throw them your way.
Anything you look at and you think, oh, that's going to be a...
I don't see any obvious surprises, but then that's the definition of a surprise.
Isn't it, though? Isn't it, though? Silly, silly me. Many, many thanks then, Paul, for being with us today. And Barry. And Ben Clissett.
It's been a pleasure, James.
Waves onion around as he...
I can barely speak.
Yes. And you, Producer Pete. We'll be off now then. Hey, have a super weekend, everybody. And we'll speak to you on Monday with Football Weekly.
Football Weekly Extra from The Guardian in association with sportingbet.com.